from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Francis gave two thumbs up to the climate change agreement signed by nearly 200 nations last week in Paris. And this week on Register Radio, Jeanette DiMello and Edward Penton look at how the Vatican has played a part in the fight against climate change for years. Also, Jeanette and Father Raymond D'Souza talk about two centuries of mercy, from the devotion to the Sacred Heart to the image of divine mercy. Welcome again to Register Radio, a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DiMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. Thanks for joining us. Our first guest, Edward Penton, is the Register's Vatican correspondent. He has also reported for a number of other publications, including Newsweek, Newsmax, and the Catholic Herald. Today, Edward's with us to discuss the Vatican's support of the United Nations climate change agreement reached last week.
Edward, it's great to have you on Register Radio again.
Good to be with you, Jeanette.
You know, last week, on Sunday, in the Pope's Angelus, he praised the climate agreement that was reached actually earlier that day. It was December 13th. By the United Nations. He called this, and many others have called this, a historic agreement. What is the agreement, and why is it so historic?
Right. Well, it's 195 countries have signed up to this agreement. It's called the Paris Agreement. It was the fruit of 2 weeks of negotiations hosted by the United Nations in Paris. And they agreed to basically try to keep global temperature rise not higher than 1.5 degrees Celsius, and which is quite an ambitious target,
right?
And also to give quite a lot of, well, a great deal of money in trying to do that, and that's the cost is going to be amount to $100 billion a year for 5 years from 2020. So it's a big agreement, and it's half binding, but it's half voluntary. So there's some are saying, well, it's still, you know, we'll see how much of this will actually go through, and others are saying that it's historic and it's going to change the whole way the economy works. And so it's certainly a major agreement, and it's something that Pope Francis had been pushing for very strongly in the weeks leading up to the conference.
That's right.
Some very strong things about it. Yep.
That's right. You know, the Register has been preparing our year-end editions, and, you know, we look back in the year and we say, what's been going on this year? And climate change was a huge part of our look back when we're looking at this year. For the Vatican, it was a pretty big topic. I mean, the Pope's encyclical, Laudato Si, and so many other statements that he made, it really is quite remarkable. What is the Pope's interest in this topic?
Well, he really is genuinely concerned that the environment is under threat. He said in Kenya that he thought it's time to save the planet from near suicide, and he said failure to achieve an agreement at the climate change conference would be catastrophic. He's very much on board with all the sort of climate change science, which of course is contested by many other scientists. It's supported by 800 UN scientists, but there are many other very qualified scientists who disagree with it, that it is, and also the way to treat climate change. I mean, this whole argument that climate change can be changed, as it were, that humans can, you know, that we can actually
influence
the climate if we've got the will to do it and the money. Whereas others are saying, well, we just need to change the way that we build houses and make us more robust and look at it that way, which is far more a cheaper way of doing it and a more sort of realistic way, if you like, of dealing with it, they would argue. So,
in a way that's preparing for the change rather than trying to prevent the change. That's what some argue.
That's okay. Basically it. It's looking at it from different ends. But I think the Pope is very much, of course, on board with this whole way of preventing it. And I think that's caused quite a bit of debate and opposition in some quarters as well.
Now, this isn't new, though, for the Vatican or for the Holy Father to take up this issue. You wrote a story for the Register that kind of chronicled the Vatican, the Holy See's involvement on this particular topic. It began quite some time ago. When did the Holy See become interested in the environment in a rather vocal way?
Yeah, that's right, Jeanette. I mean, this hasn't sort of appeared out of nowhere. The Vatican has long been interested in the environment, and that goes back really to the first social encyclicals. It took special prominence under Paul VI. In 1971, he spoke about the possible catastrophe of not protecting the environment and safeguarding it properly and responsibly. And then it was built upon by John Paul II in a very important World Day of Peace message in 1990, laid out a lot of concerns about the climate and how to protect it. And then that was built on over the years, and then Benedict took it a step further. And gradually, over the last sort of three or four pontificates, you've seen the church become more involved in the science of the environment and environmental protection, whereas before it was more in generalities, it's become much more scientific and getting into the nitty-gritty of it all. And that's become very much the case under Pope Francis, who's gone into all kinds of sort of scientific data and minutiae in Laudato Si, which is environmental encyclical. But climate change was first mentioned by Benedict. It wasn't first mentioned by Francis, sort of giving a certain amount of weight to it. Benedict mentioned it seven times, no less, and beginning in 2007. And then Pope Francis obviously took it further and actually came out sort of in support of that science, whereas with Benedict, it was a bit more tenuous.
Sure. This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm with Edward Penton in Rome, and we're talking about climate change and the Vatican support of the recent Paris Agreement related to climate change. Edward, we've been talking about the past popes and their involvement, and Benedict really took the Vatican a step further, not only by speaking about climate change, which was different than just speaking about our care or stewardship of the environment, but he actually talked about the science a bit. But he also made some changes at the Vatican to try to help the situation, to the Vatican's contribution, I guess, to use a controversial word, but the carbon footprint. What did he do at the Vatican?
Yes, he did. Well, he did various things, from bringing in electric cars around the Vatican to installing solar panels on the Paul VI Hall. So the Paul VI Hall is basically run by solar power, which is quite ambitious. And then he also signed up to a UN protocol on the environment and safeguarding the environment within the Vatican City, which was sort of in line with other states. So he's done a lot in those years, and I think Francis is kind of building on that too. I don't know exactly whether he's doing quite so many environmental practical things like that, but certainly he's continuing with the same sort of enthusiasm for bringing on board environmental sort of practicalities and ways of improving the environment within Vatican City.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit. Pope Francis has mentioned how the environment impacts the poor. That's something he spoke about in Laudato Si, and you know, it's the comments he made after this agreement last week. What are the concerns over how the environmental changes affect the poorer nations and the poorer people?
Well, I think what he sees is a kind of injustice there, the fact that the poor countries aren't really committing the most damage to the environment. They're not the lowest consumers. They're not consuming nearly as much as the rich countries, and so their impact on the environment is less. But in fact, if the scientists are right, though, the poor countries, especially those sort of island nations, will be the ones most at risk and the most vulnerable to any kind of environmental disasters. So there is an injustice there that he sees, and he feels that it's the poor who need to be helped, especially in any kind of initiatives that might come out of this agreement. So the Holy See was pushing quite strongly during the talks to get poor countries to get a good deal, and that it would be the rich countries who would have to foot the most of the sort of $100 billion a year bill. and that it's in order to help protect the poor countries. So that's his main concern, I think, about this. And it was quite, it figured highly in Laudato Si as well.
So in the Paris Agreement, is it only money that it has been committed to helping the poorer countries, or are there any other provisions or actions that would be taken to help them in regard to the climate?
Well, I think I'm not totally sure exactly what within sort of in the detail of the agreement, whether there are sort of things for them as well, but certainly that the cost issue is one that they're very much concerned about and will be more in mind about, that they won't be footing the bill, but also the environment and any kind of initiatives going forward, that they will be considered and not forgotten.
Let me go back to the critics for a minute, that, you know, we should talk about stewardship, but we shouldn't talk about climate change. That's been part of the argument. What's the worst that could happen if we turn out to be wrong? Why is it so important to kind of stay away from the climate change science? It's like Pascal's wager, you know? What happens if we don't do it?
Well, I mean, there is this sort of feeling among certain groups that, you know, this is kind of certainly the sort of more conspiratorial thinking opponents will think that, well, it's a sort of push towards a sort of one world government where you've got, it gives more power into the government's hands to do what they like with lots of money and control the economy in a whole new way. So that's one concern, and it sort of goes against Catholic teaching in a way, and subsidiarity and all of that. So that's certainly one concern. Another is that again, that the poor, that some argue, well, although the Holy See was trying very strongly to try and protect poor nations in this agreement, if fossil fuels are put to an end because of it, that hurts poor nations, because poor nations, it's a cheap fuel for them. It keeps their economies going.
They rely on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a cheap way for them. So if you get rid of that, then that's going to hurt the poor and even cost millions of lives, as one opponent, Lord Monckton, has often said, that if you continue to deprive poor nations of fossil fuels, that's what will happen. So there's that. And then just this whole expense of it, you know, that money could be used in many other different ways. If climate change is not as sure as many scientists say it is, then there's a lot of money that's going in a way which, you know, would be wasted and could be put in far better, for far better uses. So there's that as well. So this is why it's such a
quite complex. Well, Edward, we're all out of time. It's a great conversation. Thanks so much for reporting on these matters, and I'm sure we'll see more on this climate change pack and its implications in the future. Thanks again.
Thanks, Ned. Thanks for having me on.
You know, we're now in the Year of Mercy, and when we return, Jeanette talks with Father Raymond D'Souza about what it all means. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More in a moment.
Imagine if you could help inspire millions of Catholics around the globe by providing a life-changing perspective on the events of the world. Imagine if you could bring faithful Catholic journalism to clergy, seminarians, and religious. Imagine if you could be a part of continuing Mother Angelica's dream of providing faithful Catholic news true to the teachings of the Church. You can do all this and more by donating to the National Catholic Register. The Register needs your help to continue our mission and close the funding gap we now face. You can make the difference with a donation, large or small. Go to ncregister.com/donate or mail your donation to the National Catholic Register at P.O. Box 100699, Irondale, Alabama 35210.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DeMello, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest, Father Raymond D'Souza, is a priest of the Archdiocese of Kingston, Ontario, where he serves as the Catholic chaplain at Queen's University. Father is also editor-in-chief of Convivium magazine. He was the Register's Rome correspondent from 1998 to 2003. Now a regular columnist for the Register, Father D'Souza recently wrote the commentary, Year of Mercy, more than two centuries in the making.
Father D'Souza, it's great to have you back again on Register Radio.
Good, Jeanette. I'm glad to be joining you again.
Well, we're talking about another very special occasion, and it is the Year of Mercy, and it's the Jubilee of Mercy, in fact. And Pope Francis kicked this off over 10 days ago on December 8th by opening the Holy Doors of St. Peter. Now, these Holy Doors, or Holy Doors, I guess I should say, are going to be open in cathedrals around the world, and it has a very special meaning, but, you know, I'm not sure that I could even tell you what that meaning is. Can you help to understand better what the significance of a holy door is?
Yes, well, holy door, a door connotes entry and sort of an entering into a special time of God's grace, entering into a special place. It's a place of pilgrimage. You go towards a place with the holy door. Normally, St. Peter's in Rome or special shrines, but this year, as you point out, all the cathedrals around the world have been asked to have it. And I know, especially in the United States, some of the larger dioceses actually have five or six places designated to have holy doors in different areas of the diocese. The best way to think about it is that we have symbols for Christ given the images that Christ gives to us. So, for example, Christ says, I am the light, or John the Baptist, St. John says, of he's the light of the world. And so, for example, in many of our liturgical rituals, we have candles. We have, most obviously, the Paschal candle, I am the light, it's the light of Christ. Well, Jesus says of himself, I am the gate, or I am the door, depending on how it's translated, that people pass through me, right? Those who enter into into my flock, they know who I am. I am the gate to the sheepfold. So a holy door, I mean, the door symbolizes Christ, and we enter through Christ into the flock of the church. That's the baptismal symbol. But I think the way to think about it is that it's a concrete image of the many images that the Gospels use for Christ. We have many of them. The Christ is a living water. We see how often we use water in our liturgy and our sacraments. He is the light of the world. We see how we use light. I am the bread of life. We use not just in the speaking of the Eucharist, but we sometimes use bread more broadly in Christian symbols. So you have all these different kinds of images that speak of the richness of the person of Christ, the mystery of Christ, the Gospels, and the Holy Door is one of them. So really, say, what does the Holy Door symbolize? It symbolizes, if I want to say, the open embrace of Christ.
Yes.
The open
an invitation. Yeah,
the invitation that Christ has. But if you want to summarize in a word, what does the Holy Door symbolize? You'd say it's a symbol of Christ, and it's a biblical image when Jesus says, I am the gate, or I am the door. Another way to think about it, though, kind of different, if you want to almost turn it around, is, of course, in the book of Revelation, we read that Jesus, in the book of Revelation, stands at the door and knocks. So in a certain sense, Jesus is the door. That's really the symbolism of the holy door. But we might also think of a holy door, if you want to reverse it, is, am I opening the door of my heart to the graces of this holy year?
Sure. No, and it's very important because we have to respond to the invitation. So this year as a holy year, the year of mercy, a jubilee year, is the invitation to mercy. This has been a common theme of most recent popes, and you wrote about that in the Register in a commentary that talks about two centuries of mercy. And I think the most obvious example of a recent pope who put mercy central was Pope John Paul II. There are so many ways that he did that. Why did he choose to make mercy such a central part of his pontificate?
Well, that's true. I mean, really, he is the Pope of Mercy, and bringing that to the central attention of the Church. There were two aspects of that. One was more broadly his experience of the 20th century of both Nazi totalitarianism and then communist totalitarianism. He saw really the worst that evil can do in the world in his experience growing up and living his adult life in Poland. And he said that the limit to evil in the world is divine mercy, that God intervenes with his mercy to put a limit to what human wickedness can do. Secondly, John Paul was familiar with the revelations to Sister Faustina, what became the Diary of Divine Mercy. This took place in Krakow. She died in the convent close by where John Paul wasn't in Krakow when she died there, but he would walk by that convent in his young adult days. He knew about Faustina. He knew about the diary. He knew about divine mercy. And so he had a concrete experience of this devotion in Krakow that he then brought with him when he came to Rome as pope. And so those two things led him to write about the mercy. This is 35 years since his encyclical on mercy. And then, of course, in the Jubilee year, he canonized Faustina as the first saint of the new millennium and instituted the Feast of Divine Mercy. More important than either of those initiatives, of course, is the fact that he died in a very providential way on the Feast of Divine Mercy in 2005. So this was a very central thing to St. John Paul's preaching and pontificate. But as I pointed out in that column that you mentioned, that commentary, the focus on the mercy of the Father, the merciful heart of Jesus, this personal encounter with the mercy of God is something that goes back, I would say, two centuries. Mm-hmm. And the 19th century witnessed a real flourishing of devotion to the Sacred Heart, so much so that by the early 20th century, you would be hard-pressed, I think, to find a parish or even a Catholic home that didn't have an image of the Sacred Heart somewhere.
Sure.
And that the Divine Mercy devotion, in many ways, is in direct continuity. Some people have even said it's the same devotion, right? To the Sacred Heart, the loving heart, the wounded heart of Christ, or the merciful heart, the merciful of Divine Mercy. So I think that over about two centuries, we've seen an increasing devotion, not so much to the God who's omnipotent, although he remains that, obviously, not to the God who is the creator, although, of course, he is, not all these different things that God is, but a particular emphasis on God, the one who loves, the one who's merciful, the one who bleeds and is wounded for us. And we see that in the 19th century, really, even up until, say, 1950, with a very key emphasis on the Sacred Heart. Pope Leo XIII, in the holy year of 1900, consecrated the whole world to the Sacred Heart of Jesus and built the holy year of 1900 around the idea of the Sacred Heart. And then, of course, by the time we get to 2000, Divine Mercy is at the center of that jubilee.
Absolutely. This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Father Raymond D'Souza, and we are talking about the Jubilee of Mercy. We're talking about two beautiful icons of mercy, the image of the Sacred Heart, as well as the image of the Divine Mercy of Jesus, the image Sister Faustina made so popular. And, you know, it makes me wonder what the image might be after this year, if there will be another image that gains interest and popularity in this year of mercy. I hope there might be something that can capture the attention as these two beautiful images did. But, you know, I also think about something I've heard from various people as we began this year, or even started talking about it before it began, and that is the tension that sometimes exists in our own lives between mercy and what we might say truth, or calling someone to change before we have even extended the love that might help them to change. How do we make sense of this in our own lives, this tension that exists in our own lives?
Well, I think to try and reconcile these things in an abstract way, mercy and truth, or mercy and justice, or love and justice, it can, you know, to put them together abstractly, I mean, it can and ought to be done by, especially in the work of speculative theology. But mm-hmm. I think it's actually much more simple than that for most people, because we experience it in our human relationships. All of us know in family life that part of the role of the parents is to correct and reprimand, and sometimes even punish the children. So we've been on both sides of that, most of us.
Right.
But we also know that to be punished by someone, or to be corrected by someone, or to be guided by someone in whom we are confident, we have confidence of his love for me, is a much different thing than if we don't know that.
Right, that's true.
And so if you ask yourself, well, how do you put together mercy and truth, mercy and justice? Well, We probably have learned the lessons of that, probably how to do it, and also probably how not to do it, in our own families and amongst our friends. Mm-hmm. I think it's correct. I think the Holy Father at the opening Mass on December the 8th, I believe he quoted St. Augustine, I'd have to check to be sure, that St. Augustine said that we ought to be careful that before we speak of the God who is just or the God who reveals truth, we have to mention that, remember that this is the God who is merciful, because even to create us is an act of mercy. The reason St. Augustine said that is because if we are confident in God's mercy, if we really believe that, if that's what is our sort of introduction, then no matter how difficult a particular truth might be, no matter how hard a particular conversion might be, we're inclined to receive it as good news.
Sure.
If we don't have that idea of God's mercy, Even a beautiful truth can seem to us as a kind of a difficulty, or even an assault,
That's right.
an attack. So I think that that's the key. Is if we are confident of God's mercy, I think that's why the Holy Father, Pope Francis, wants to emphasize this, is then everything else then I think becomes easier to receive. But
sure.
If we forget about that, then everything becomes more difficult to receive.
Yes, what you just said really made me think about often we have a tendency to look at ourselves, especially those of us who are really attempting to live a Christian life. And you say a jubilee of mercy, so we start to examine our own conscience and look at ourselves. How do we need mercy, etc.? But perhaps the first place, the most important place to start is to actually start by gazing at one of these images that we've mentioned and to really love and look at the source of that mercy before we even begin to examine ourselves. That's probably a good place for us to start this this new year. We just have a 1 little minute to
right.
sum up. What would you like to leave us with as we begin to journey this year?
Well, I think that I would encourage people to remember that mercy is God's love shown to us in our weakness.
Hmm.
And I would just say, before we think about our sins that God forgives in his mercy, even though that's how we primarily experience mercy, forgiveness for sins, start by thinking about the very fact that God created me, the very fact that God came to me in baptism, the very fact that God appears on our altars in the Eucharist, the very fact that God gave me people to introduce me to the faith,
right?
My family, all of these are acts of mercy. There's no reason not to think about my sins and their forgiveness as an act of God's mercy. But mercy is much richer than that. It's broader than that. And I think it's sometimes we can, although we can rejoice in the forgiveness of our sins, sometimes that can be, it's sort of a mixed joy because we're also contrite and maybe even embarrassed. But when we think about God's mercy extended to me in the gift of life and the gift of faith and the gift of the sacraments, I think that's a good starting point to remember all of this is God's mercy, and that's what we're celebrating in this Jubilee year.
Father De Souza, thanks so much for sharing with us today, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Great. Thank you, Jeanette. A blessed Advent to you.
Don't forget, you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com. Look for the microphone to listen or download the show. Thanks for joining us this time on Register Radio. For our producer, Elena Rodriguez, Jeanette, and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. Merry Christmas.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.